Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis.
Welcome to Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. In this case, we mean from the ground up, literally. We're talking about solar and farmland. So I got good news and bad news. The good, according to the FERC, there's around 200 gigawatts of new solar capacity in the U.S. pipeline. The bad, only a third of this is what they deem highly probable to come online in the next 3 years. Inflation and rising interest rates and workforce shortages will take their toll. And then there are supply delays and trade issues with China.
Meanwhile, there's this other problem here at home. Folks in rural America saying, not in my back 40. Nearly 70 large solar projects were nixed in rural counties in just the past year.
So here's the question. Should we be putting solar farms on ag land?
Do we even need to? To get to 100% clean energy, how much land for solar panels do we really need?
The total amount of land that we would need is less than 0.5% of the United States' total area.
That's Jordan Makak, lead water, energy, and land analyst at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. And that less than 0.5% is around 10 million acres.
Which, in regular people speak, is the size of two New Jerseys, or one Lake Erie.
Right now, the U.S. area covered by solar is only about the size of Rhode Island. So if we're going to reach that 100% clean energy goal, we've got a long, long way to go. And solar developers are salivating over farmland. It's flat, already cleared, has roads and connections to the grid. And between aging farmers, extreme weather, and the general unprofitability of farming these days, there are lots of farmers willing to sign solar leases. Jordan says we could reach our solar goals without touching a square inch of ag land, but there's still going to be somebody against it.
Put your finger on any single point on the map. There will be someone who either owns that land or is trying to protect that land or who cherishes that land or who doesn't want to see any development on that land. And so every single square inch of land in the United States has someone with a vested interest in not seeing any change to what happens in that land.
Well, what about land that no one wants, like brownfields?
I led a study where we said we can meet all of the United States' solar development goals without touching one single acre of agricultural land if we are able to build on contaminated and disturbed lands throughout the United States. So areas that have been previously contaminated with chemicals, we can't farm on them, we can't build on them, we can't really do anything with them. There's more than enough land in that land base to meet our solar development goals. That being said, there's challenges with developing on brownfield sites, liability concerns, safety issues, and land stability issues. And so there's challenges with that, too.
So with people arguing against solar farms wherever a developer wants to put one, farmland still has all those advantages we laid out earlier.
And solar developers are willing to pay a premium for those advantages. So solar leases are the new cash crop. But what if it wasn't either or, farming or solar? What if you could do both?
Farmers and researchers are working together to answer that question at places like Jack's Solar Garden in Longmont, Colorado.
My grandfather, Jack Stingery, farmed here before he passed on.
That's Byron Komenek, the co-owner of Jack's.
The farm passed down to Byron's parents. Byron grew up and left for a career as a government diplomat, but he came home in 2019 to work the farm with his dad.
Until then, the land had mainly grown hay, but they needed to find an alternative.
Hay really didn't make any money for the farm. Didn't even pay back all of the bills that we had. We were losing money on the farm.
Hosting a community solar garden seemed like a good answer.
That matched my ideals of community and trying to push society forward. I went around to a couple of solar developers and asked them, like, how much would you pay us to just put up a solar array on our farm? One company said, how about $600 an acre a year? I said, nah, I don't want to do that. The next week they came back and offered $1,200 an acre a year. I said, so you just doubled the price in a week. There must be some money to be made here. Let me figure this out on my own. It took a few years of my life. We put up our land as collateral to a bank to get a good chunk of the change. We sold electricity up front to residents as well as our local governments. In 2020, we built a 1.2 megawatt community solar garden. And that's enough power for about 300 homes. It takes up just over 4 acres of land on one of my hay pastures.
Jack's Solar Garden provides power to the community.
50 residential subscribers, 5 commercial subscribers, and 2 local government purchase electricity from us.
But Jax is not just your run-of-the-mill solar farm. It's also a site where farmers and researchers are working together to discover how to keep land under the panels healthy and productive.
What first got Byron thinking about growing food under his panels was a simple observation.
We're in Boulder County, Colorado, just east of the Rocky Mountains in the plains, at about 5,000 feet in elevation on a very flat farm. They used to say 12 to 14 inches of rain, but I don't think we get that anymore.
The growing season is short, the summers are hot, and it's increasingly dry.
I have an elm tree on the west side of one of my hay pastures. And the best, thickest, densest alfalfa and brome grass I have is in the afternoon shade of that elm tree. I remember seeing that in my pasture for a couple of years, wondering why it was thicker, and then just slowly realizing, well, the only difference between this piece of land and anywhere else on my property is the elm tree.
It turns out that the shade from solar panels can be a blessing for farmers.
There's a lot of crops that prefer having a little bit more shade.
So when Byron planned his solar farm, he built in room to grow.
A lot of the types of plants that we want to grow for society need space. Tapeno plants go 5 feet tall. Squash plants can be 3 feet tall. And solar developers can give that space if they put the panels up higher.
Conventional solar farms in Colorado leave about 4 feet of clearance between the panels and the ground. The panels at Jax have a clearance of 6 to 8 feet.
I'm 6'4". I'll tell you, I prefer the 8-foot side.
Projects that combine solar and agriculture like this are called dual-use, or agrivoltaic. There are hundreds of dual-use solar projects in the U.S., but most either graze sheep or grow native vegetation for pollinators.
Those types of dual uses are relatively easy, and they make great PR. They're already taking place at hundreds of commercial solar projects. But actually growing and harvesting crops under solar panels is much more challenging and has yet to expand beyond the experimental. Byron wanted to help.
An old diplomat colleague introduced Byron to Jordan, who leads the country's largest research program on agrivoltaics. The project is called INSPIRE, which is an acronym for Innovative Solar Practices Integrated with Rural Economies and Ecosystems.
A common problem when multiple researchers study the same topic is that you end up with apples and oranges, results that you can't compare or combine. All of the government agencies and universities doing research under INSPIRE's umbrella are using the same standardized methods to collect and analyze data.
INSPIRE's researchers are studying agrivoltaics at 29 sites across the U.S. Most of these sites are really small. At 4 acres, Jax is the largest, and it's hosting 3 different research teams, one from NREL, one from the University of Colorado, and one from the University of Arizona.
INSPIRE researchers are looking for answers to a number of questions which are needed for agrivoltaics to scale from little research plots to commercial-sized solar installations, like how to build a solar project that's farming-friendly. Farmers are an important part of the research teams at Jax. Byron grows hay and Sprout City Farms grows vegetables. They're a Denver area urban farming outfit, which grows produce for community-supported agriculture. Members buy subscriptions for a season's share of produce. But as a nonprofit focused on food access, they give half their veggie shares to low-income Denverites for free.
So free or low-cost land is really helpful.
In addition to its half acre at Jax, Sprout farms at a school and a city park.
We basically form relationships with places that have space that is available for transformation.
That's Eliza McConnell, who manages the farm at Jax. Eliza and her crew are an important part of learning the down-to-earth side of agrivoltaics, like how to farm around solar panels.
The panels pivot on an axis from east to west. At certain points of the day, there's a low edge in one spot, and then at another time of day, the low edge is in the other spot. So you have to kind of strategically plan that, oh, we're going to work on the east side in the morning and the west side in the afternoon.
Byron does the same thing on his tractor.
When the panels turn to the west, then I can drive on the east side. When the panels turn to the east, then I can drive on the west side.
The Sprouts farmers found that simply raising the panels wasn't enough. While there's 11 feet between the rows of solar panels, enough space for Byron to drive his tractor, there are no pathways to get across the rows.
We do a lot of ducking underneath the panels, carrying crates of vegetables. And that's really a design lesson. Farming, you have to be efficient. Your highest cost is labor. If your staff has to make too many movements to harvest the vegetables, then they're spending their physical energy and time. And that is going to cost you more. It's going to be impossible to come up with a workable business plan. So it really goes back to the design. If you designed the layout in such a way to accommodate your farming needs, then work doesn't have to be much more. We're going to create some pathways within the layout that we have. So we are sort of retrofitting some of that and thinking about if we could do Jack Solar Garden 2.0, how would we design it?
Some of those ideas are already finding their way into the design of new agrivoltaic projects.
Inspire sites experimenting with different panel configurations are also looking at the cost. Since higher panels means more steel and wider spacing means less kilowatts per acre.
Another question is which plants will grow best in different regions and soil types.
We're combining this assessment of which plants grow best underneath the panels with a lot of detailed instrumentation. We have microclimate sensors that can look at the different temperature, the different light impacts, the different humidity impacts, the different soil moisture impacts that are happening directly underneath panels as well as in between rows of panels. That is helping us better understand why certain species are thriving and why others aren't.
Another topic under study is soil.
The impacts of solar projects on soil health is a major focus of our research, and it's one of the top questions we get from everyone, especially farmers who say, I want to make sure we're leaving this land in better condition than when it started.
One of Inspire's longest-running projects is a 10-year-old solar array on the Renewable Energy Lab's own campus. The soil there is still recovering.
A decade ago, a lot of projects were developed in a way that sort of mimicked a new housing development. You would come in, remove the vegetation, remove the topsoil, flatten the ground, make it perfectly flat, and then install your solar infrastructure. That had some pretty major impacts on soil quality, can lead to erosion, can lead to other major challenges. More recently, solar developers have recognized that low impact development techniques can not only be more environmentally friendly, but also more cost friendly. Because if you can build projects without having to remove vegetation, without having to flatten the ground, without having to disrupt the soil ecosystem that you do have, you can avoid usage of large pieces of equipment, and you're able to develop system faster than you could if you did have to completely transform the land. And so this has been enabled by advances in racking technologies, advances in development techniques, et cetera. But we are seeing that current techniques are more often than not using these low impact approaches from the get-go.
This is Cool Solutions with stories of climate action from the bottom up. We're talking with folks in Colorado who are studying how to grow solar energy and food on the same land. This is Jordan Macneck from the National Renewable Energy Lab sharing some early results.
A couple elements that really have surprised us as we've been doing our research in different parts of the country. One is how well things grow, even in this shady environment. We had really anticipated that in cooler, not as sunny areas like Minnesota or Massachusetts or Oregon, we wouldn't have as much growth and as much success in vegetation under the panels as we have. And I think that's been a very encouraging sign that we're able to see pretty robust, substantial yields, even in areas that you would say, no, it's never going to work there. Another surprising element is the degree to which farmers have taken an interest in agrivoltaics. Most farmers, when they hear about agrivoltaics, they're still pretty skeptical. They think, that'll never work. That doesn't make any sense. There's too much shade. There's not enough space. I can't get my equipment in there. And then they go to a site and then they see, oh, here's a farmer working with their tractor, growing food underneath and in between the panels. Something clicks and they can understand, oh yeah, this is not some pie in the sky imaginary concept. This is real. I can grow food in this context and I can potentially make more money growing food in this way than I can in my current approach.
Because solar is definitely more lucrative than farming.
as we look at the economics of agrivoltaics, one thing that jumps out very, very clearly is that unless you are growing a very high value crop, such as grapes in California, the revenue that you will get from selling electrons can be 5 to 10 times more than the revenue you're going to be receiving from selling potatoes or selling other sorts of vegetables or other types of crops on your land.
According to the USDA, a shocking half of U.S. farms don't break even. So if farming is a labor of love or an act of stewardship, to put it in less mushy terms, solar panels might someday be the income stream that helps those farmers keep farming. While it will take more than one growing season to come to solid conclusions, results thus far at JAC suggest that solar may increase yields of some species and provide a hedge against global warming.
There's been some clear winners for certain types of crops that are universal. Now, agriculture is very diverse across the United States, and you know, each region has different specialties and different things that they grow. But one thing that we've seen pretty consistently perform really well or even better in an agrivoltaics context are leafy greens. So things like kale or chard or lettuces. These leafy greens really tend to appreciate that partial shade, especially in the hotter parts of the day. This allows for greater photosynthesis rates, which can lead to larger leaf size as well as larger overall yields from each plant.
I was surprised at how enormous the leaves of chard were that we grew under the solar panels compared to what leaves of chard normally look like on a Colorado vegetable farm. They were enormous. One of our staff was comparing the size of the leaves to the size of her dog. Another was comparing it to the size of her toddler. And it continued producing all season, these enormous leaves. They're so beautiful anyway, the rainbow chard. They're so striking looking. And just to have them be enormous, it was a little bit sci-fi.
Hold up. My nerdy side needs a science minute. Jordan said that the leaves get so big because there's more photosynthesis. But how can there be more photosynthesis when there's less sun?
How that works is through something that's called the midday depression of photosynthesis. So what happens with many crops that are in the open air environment with no shade is that in the early morning, they're very happy when the sun hits because the temperatures are cool. But as temperatures rise throughout the day, photosynthesis will stop or decline until later on in the evening when the temperatures are cooler again. Agrivoltaics helps delay the onset of those higher temperatures that stop photosynthesis. Even if the total amount of sunlight that hits a plant is less, there can be more photosynthesis, which equates to higher yields, bigger leaf size, etc. And so that's the counterintuitive mechanism for how having more shade can lead to higher yields.
Liza points out that farm workers also need shade.
Heat is no joke in terms of what it does to the human body.
I don't know if you remember, but we talked to a kidney specialist a while back who told us about rising rates of kidney damage in young men who work outdoors in the heat. Two recent studies show that can largely be prevented by providing breaks in the shade.
Even though a good part of the middle of our day, we're still working in the direct sun. Just a few feet away, there is a patch of shade that we can step into. Most vegetable farms I've worked at, you have to walk up to half a mile to get to any shaded space.
Another effect of the panels is extension of the growing season.
Our brome grass and alfalfa started growing earlier and getting greener earlier in the season underneath our solar panels compared to outside. In my other pasture throughout April, we didn't get any rain. And so my pasture outside of the solar array was completely dry and brown until maybe the first or second week of May. Whereas the grass growing underneath our solar panels was already green by the end of March.
Where Byron's hay got an early start, Liza had extended harvests.
There's only certain varieties of lettuce that you can grow in the heat of the Colorado sun. Normally, you'd be finished with them in May. We were able to harvest them at the end of June and into early July because they had some sun protection from the shade of the solar panels. And they were quite tasty and quite large, and we're able to conserve some water in the process.
That's important, especially in the drought-prone West.
When Liza says her lettuce was tasty, That's not coming from farmer bias.
Nope. That's the result of double-blind controlled study, aka taste test.
We had a tour group visiting that day, so we were able to bring them in on the taste test. The lettuce that we grew in the control pot for comparison was essentially inedible. One section that was planted and watered with a full amount of water. We had another section planted that had 50% of that amount. And even though the heads were slightly smaller, they tasted better in the 50%. When you do that taste test, you're like, oh yeah, I can actually taste the difference. So that shows a potential for an expanded market of a very desirable crop that can be grown potentially with less water and better results.
Solar panels also provide climate resilience for crops, as Inspire researchers found out in Massachusetts.
In your normal, if you will, summers in Massachusetts, for certain crops like peppers, we're seeing reductions in yields because there's just not enough sunlight really for what that plant would want. But 2017 was a very hot and dry year in Massachusetts. The plants actually appreciated that additional shade, the additional temperature reduction. And so even in a place like Massachusetts, which is not known for having an excess of sun, we actually saw some crop yield benefits from the panel shading in those hot and dry summer years compared to the open air control.
When the soil is cooler, more moisture stays in the soil instead of evaporating. As the Sprout City farmers discovered with their lettuce, that reduces the need for irrigation.
This can be a really important outcome, especially where we have hot and dry conditions. One of our research sites is at the Biosphere 2 facility in Arizona, and we were able to achieve a doubling of tomato yields and a tripling of a certain types of peppers, all while using about a third less water than what we would normally use in open air conditions, increasing yields while using less water.
Here's something else that's kind of neat. The cooling goes both ways. Just like plants slow down photosynthesis when they get hot, solar arrays can get so hot that they create their own heat island effect and reduce their own efficiency.
When plants growing under panels transpire and release water from their leaves, the evaporating water cools the underside of the panels, so they generate more electricity.
The solar panels not only cool the air beneath them in the daytime, they also keep that air warmer at night when temperatures are at their lowest.
We saw that last year when we had a frost in September. All the plants underneath the solar panels didn't have frost damage except for the top few inches of a 5-foot tall tomato plant.
A big component of the research is finding plant varieties which thrive under solar panels. There are differences. It's not potato, potato. For example, in Arizona, they tried two types of peppers, jalapenos and chiltepines.
They're a tiny native variety, 20 times hotter than jalapenos.
The yield of chiltepines tripled under solar.
The jalapenos just did so-so.
Liza also found big differences between varieties of dried beans.
One variety did much, much better and was ready much sooner than the other two that we grew. And we thought, oh, instead of growing three varieties, we should grow 10 varieties.
That would speed things up, since research moves at Mother Nature's pace.
You know how often we get to test growing tomatoes each year? One time. We're not sitting in a laboratory like app developers that can test out 100 different models of something in 1 hour. It takes one full growing season to see how well something grew.
And that creates this huge tension.
On one hand, we're dealing with a very, very rapid expansion of solar development. It's happening at such an extremely fast pace right now. Solar developers want to know, can I do agrivoltaics here? What's the best crop to do here? What's the best type of ecosystem services we can do here? How do I do grazing? I need to know now because I'm building 10 projects this next year that are going to be in existence for the next 25 years. At the same time, we're trying to do agricultural research, which you want 5 years of data, maybe 10 years of data to really capture what's happening with the soil, really capture all the variability that can inform what species will grow, what types of crops will do best. We have developers saying, I need this information yesterday. And then we say, hey, we don't know enough yet. We can't make that determination. But rather than be overwhelmed or think, oh my gosh, we are venturing into uncharted territory, I try to really look at this as an exciting opportunity to really learn a lot very fast.
And then get that knowledge expeditiously into the hands of the folks who need it.
Journal publication and scientific research goes through certain channels that take a long time. That's not always great and interesting for companies who are trying to make decisions right now. And so one of the unique aspects of our Inspire project is that every 3 months, we're bringing together 75 to 100 people that are involved in the solar industry from all aspects and sharing what we've learned, not only from our individual research projects, but industry perspectives and other research projects and anyone else who's in that community. And so that's how we try to bridge that divide of still allowing for our scientific research to proceed on its more slow path, but yet giving those little nuggets of insights to industry and trying to share as much information as we can.
Last year, Sprouts grew 8,000 pounds of tomatoes, peppers, potatoes, dry beans, and greens in their experimental plot at Jack's. This year, they'll expand the research plot to add onions and garlic and add 3 non-research acres for a market garden. Could that mean a share of veggies for every household powered by the panels overhead?
That's a question I can answer at the end of next year, but I'd like to think we could.
One more thing that will be needed to bring agrivoltaic crop production into the mainstream is money. 2 states worried about losing farmland to solar have developed policies to help. New Jersey, which is losing 17 acres of farmland a day, has devoted $2 million to a pilot program to support farmers who want to go agrivoltaic. In Massachusetts, where 1/4 of all farmland developed in recent years has gone for solar, utilities must pay a 6-cent per kilowatt incentive for solar grown over farmland that remains in cultivation. That's a bonus of about 20 to 30%. Other states have yet to develop policies supporting agrivoltaics, but Byron, like Jordan, thinks that seeing is believing.
Policymakers haven't come out to Jack's Solar Garden yet to see what's possible. So once they do come out, then maybe they'll change their mind on something.
Just bring out that toddler-sized chard. For joining us on Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up.
Thanks to Jordan Macnick, Byron Komenick, and Liza McConnell.
And thanks to Scott Holmes, Jason Shaw, and Michael Cobran for our music.